Today's program is brought to you by Cane Vineyard and Winery, a Napa Valley winery committed to respecting the soil and dedicated to the creation of three Cabernet blends. For more information, visit cane5.com.
I'm Erin Fairbanks, host of The Farm Report. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
The earliest settlers in America, the Dutch, left a culinary imprint on America's kitchen and a long trail of goodies. We'll find out more about that, and we'll learn about the stroopwafel on today's A Taste of the Past. Welcome to A Taste of the Past. I'm your host, Linda Palaccio, on this journey through culinary history. And indeed, several of the mainstays of the American diet were brought to the New World by the Dutch, including such things, well, we can say perhaps such things as pancakes, definitely waffles, cookies, and the precursor of donuts, coleslaw, pretzels. But we've adopted them and consider them American classics. My guest today has made it her life's work to uncover and write about those early foodways and contributions of Dutch settlers. She is Peter Rose, a Dutch immigrant and a food historian. Peter was born in Utrecht, the Netherlands, and was educated there as well as in Switzerland. She came to the U.S. in the mid-60s and has worked as a food writer and contributed a syndicated column on food and cooking in the New York-based Gannett newspapers for more than 20 years. She's written articles for magazines like Gourmet and Saveur, and as well as newspapers in the Netherlands and the New York Hudson Valley region. Very Dutch. Her first book was The Sensible Cook, Dutch Foodways in the Old and New World. And this was really an edited translation and version of a 17th century Dutch cookbook called De Verstandige Cook. I think I'll let her pronounce that one. That's not so good, but she'll tell us all about that. And she followed up that publication with several other books on the food, particularly of the Hudson Valley, and also Dutch flavors, such as the Matters of Taste, Food and Drink in 17th Century Dutch Art and Life, along with Dr. Donna Barnes. And she does wonderful lectures on food in the old Dutch master's paintings. Very interesting. Peter was the recipient of the Alice P. Kinney Award for Research and Writing on Dutch Food History. And it is with great pleasure that I welcome her to the show today. Welcome, Peter.
Thank you, Linda. Nice to talk to you.
Some years back, the New York Times wrote about you that you're a lively, talkative woman with a penchant for fine food, and that you have spent the last several years trying to recreate the lives of original Dutch settlers from the pantry out. And you would like to show Americans that they owe a debt of gastronomical gratitude to the Dutch for the foods that they brought with them. So my first question to you is, why do you think that the Dutch roots of so many of these foods have been, well, ignored or forgotten or overshadowed, perhaps, by the English?
I think in the first place by the English, America plays up their English roots and English heritage and so on, but those Dutch roots are there, and they were very well documented, but of course documented in Dutch, and who can read Dutch here? So since 1974, there's been an extensive program out of the New York State Library The program initially was called the New Netherlands Project. Now it's called, more impressively, the New Netherlands Institute. And they have translated and are still in the process of translating the Dutch documents that remain, a mere 12,000 plus.
Wow.
So you can imagine they're still busy.
Right. Well, in fact, the Dutch colonies back in the early 1600s were called New Netherlands, correct?
New Netherland.
Singular. Ah, New Netherland. Okay. And,
yeah.
And that comprised quite a bit of the Northeast, did it not?
Exactly. And that's so nice of you to ask, because people think it's just the Hudson Valley. But that's not true. It's the present-day states of New York, New Jersey, and Delaware, as well as parts of Maryland, Connecticut, and Pennsylvania. So it was a huge area that ranged from the Connecticut River in the north to the Delaware Bay. So quite a large area.
Now, you've written a lot about the early settlements, and it was the East India Trading Company that basically was responsible?
The West India.
West India.
Trading Company.
Okay.
It was founded in 1621, and the East India Company was a little before that, in 1602.
Hmm. Well, I found it very interesting that you, in a lot of your research and translation of that early cookbook, please say the name of the in Dutch of the sensible cook for me.
That's a really Dutch sound. It's de verstandige kok.
Well, I certainly did not get that right. But anyway, it's the
good try.
Right. It means the sensible cook.
We
right.
are known for our guttural sounds, like you say Gouda cheese, and we say Gouda.
Oh. Okay.
Yes, clear your throat.
Right, okay. Well, I like it by its English name, the sensible cook, or American name, and that makes a lot more sense to me. But when you started to do the work on this, you were doing a lot of research and discovered that there were quite a few copies of this, and tell us, a lot of people brought it with them?
Well, we're not sure, but it seems that settlers who were here sent home and requested for books to be sent to them. We have multiple letters to that effect. And the fact that the book is in so many libraries in America seems to point that way.
Hmm. Sort of like taking the joy of cooking, because it was a very common recipe.
Exactly.
Right? Yeah.
It was a very popular book, which contained actually, and that's why it was so popular, not only a cookbook, but also a book on gardening and how to grow plants and how to root them and so forth.
They should have called it the Book for Settlers, right?
Perfect. In a way, yeah.
Yeah. You also had to, I'm sure, study a lot of manuscripts, handwritten manuscripts, for a lot of your research, did you not?
Oh, of course. And that was really so much fun, because the sensible cook gave me sort of a basic knowledge of what the Dutch ate at the time. But then by looking at menus from orphanages and menus from colleges, what they've fed their students, and then go and augment it with cookbooks handwritten by settlers' descendants was fascinating. And you mentioned a list of things that we have to thank the Dutch for here. And over recipes for those appear in those books. Hmm. There's always a recipe for oliekoeken or oil cakes, literally the forerunner of the donut, and for waffles and wafers and pretzels and coleslaw, and of course cookies, as well as pancakes and other really what I would feel are really Dutch items.
Uh-huh. In fact, we even owe the word cookie to the Dutch from their
original. Yeah. My family always teases me because I tend to say cookie with a real oo, the way we pronounce it in Dutch.
Oh, that's interesting. Well, something that I found wonderfully fascinating is that you looked at some of the ship inventories of some of the early settlers, and that one of the cooking items most popular that they brought with them was a waffle iron?
Yeah, so. Both waffle and wafer irons.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, 20 years ago when I would say that, people would sort of look at me and not know what a wafer is. And now I say stroopwafels, and all of a sudden they understand. Wafers are very thin cookies made in a wafer iron in the way you make a much thicker waffle.
Mm. And delicious, too. Well, tell me, what were some of the important items of the Dutch diet, the early settlers of the Dutch diet?
Well, when they came here, the object was not only to trade with Native Americans, but also to be able to outfit ships that would stop here and go on to trade in farther in the Atlantic, in the Caribbean, and so forth. So the object was to have an extensive agriculture here. And they brought with them their vegetable seeds, the tree stock, for fruit trees. We have diaries that tell that Dutch people who came to the to New Netherland and saw the apple trees here said they had never seen better apples. And they also brought their animals, oxen, horses, cows, and of course pigs, and chickens were on board of those kind of boats anyway.
Which is very interesting because the Native Americans, particularly in this northeast region, they had never, I mean, that was not part of their diet. Chickens and pork did not exist. They weren't here, right?
The pigs in particular would cause havoc, because the old way of keeping them was just to let them go, essentially, and forage for them themselves. And they would uproot gardens, and there would be some disputes between Native Americans and the Dutch when, you know, the pigs had uprooted their gardens. There also is a wonderful story about the pigs uprooting the walls of the fort in New Amsterdam. And, you know, just picture pigs in Manhattan right now.
Yeah, that would be something. All right. I know the Dutch liked their beer, particularly the settlers, and they were some of the, you know, the early brewers to settle here. Beer had been around for tens of thousands of years, of course, from the Egyptians, but they were quite the brewers, and they loved their bread. So bread and beer, that goes together.
It sure does, and in the Netherlands and here, beer was part of the daily diet, really. Beer was the drink, although we have an account for, saying that the water in New Netherlands is so pure it can be readily drunk from a stream. But of course, for people used to drinking beer, that was the drink of choice, as well as wine. But the general drink was beer, indeed.
Mm. Yeah, you know, there's so much going on today with grains, not only ancient grains, but grains, local grains, that growing in particular areas, and the types of breads made. And it was interesting to read that the Dutch were really such front runners in that they really relegated certain grains to types of bread and who could eat those grains or not. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Well, the idea is that the more affluent class ate the bread made with sifted flour. And when you sift flour, you lose a portion of it. Therefore, you need more to make the bread. Therefore, it is more expensive.
So we're talking like refined white flour, more or less?
White flour, exactly. So the working class and the poor, therefore, ate rye bread, or the way it is generally referred to as black bread. And our roggebrood, which means rye bread, is very dark in color. And you can see it on 17th century paintings. It is almost black. So white bread was herenbrood, or gentleman's bread, and black bread was the bread of the poor. And it's not that the poor couldn't or weren't allowed to eat white bread, it's just they couldn't afford it. In the Deacon's record of the Dutch Reformed Church on Flatbush Avenue in Brooklyn is a record of Duivekaters, which was a beautiful big holiday bread made from white flour, was given to the poor on New Year's Day. So it was a special kind of thing if you were poor.
Well, and then the oliekoeks or oily cakes, which, as you say, were the definite precursor to the donut. What would they have been like? You know, like I know you've talked about a recipe in one of your writings about it. How would they be?
Oh, they are fabulous. The recipe calls for a couple of pounds of wheat flour, and then raisins, apples, almonds mixed in, and milk and yeast, of course, and then flavored with cinnamon, cloves, and ginger. And it makes a terrific ball of dough, so to speak, which is scooped up with a spoon and dropped in hot fat or oil. And it makes a more or less round ball that becomes a very, very good tasting baked good, if you wish, or fried good.
It sounds good. It sounds delicious.
I'll bake you some.
Okay. You know, you mentioned that the early settlers brought tree stock with them, which we read about often with all of the different settlers. You know, even not that long ago, you know, Italians bringing their fig sprigs with them so they can plant fig trees here. And but so important to realize, you know, that America was, yes, we had apples, but there are so many of our fruits and vegetables that we really owe to these settlers who had the foresight to bring the tree stock with them to plant on this land. But then I thought it was interesting, too, because you wrote about how you mentioned that they saw all the apples growing here when they arrived, and that how the Dutch were some of the first to incorporate all these apples in their recipes.
Yes, well, it's just they grow well in the Netherlands, so when they're there, they found ways to use them. And use them even in what would be a main dish. You know, there's a delicious dish of apples, and nowadays potatoes and pork together. And that brings me actually to mention chutzpot, which translated in English is hodgepodge. It's a dish of a mixture of various foodstuffs, root vegetables, meat, all cooked in one pot.
And that's a stew, but if it's a hodgepodge stew. Interesting.
Yeah.
The pancakes, of course, we think of in the Dutch baby. We think of a Dutch pancake. I don't think people think about the name Dutch, but they just call it a Dutch baby for a big puffy pancake with apples in it. Pretzels kind of surprised me.
Well, they were made because you think they're German.
Mm-hmm.
They were made in the lowlands, so they certainly are not all German. And in a recipe book from the bakers, I found a recipe that calls for them to be made with a little cinnamon and a little sugar. And so they're not what you eat on the streets of New York.
Uh-huh. Yeah, so they are a little bit more sweet pretzel or, you know.
Yeah.
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 Interesting. Well, Peter, thank you so much for sharing this information. I encourage people to recognize the Dutch contributions to our American diet, particularly in the sweets. And I did not mention one of your most recent books, and that is that Summer and Winter Pleasures?
No, actually, it's called Delicious December. That's my latest.
Yes, Delicious December.
Yeah. A book about holiday treats.
Wonderful. Well, there, and you can look for that. And Peter Rose, it's always a pleasure to talk to you. You are really my go-to source for any information on the culinary roots of Dutch cuisine. And stay tuned, because after this, we are going to be talking about something you mentioned earlier, the stroopwafel. So when we come back from a break, we'll tell you all you need to know about that, jumping a century ahead. You're listening to A Taste of the Past. Stay tuned.
I went down to North Carolina, realized there was surely nothing finer. Hopped into a tiny highway diner, met the daughter of an old coal miner. She said, oh, take me home.
This is Chris Howell from Cane Vineyard and Winery, calling in from Spring Mountain above the Napa Valley. Thank you for listening to this show. In our industrial world of highly processed food and wine, we support the values of Heritage Radio Network. All of us at Cane encourage you to seek out individuality and beauty in everything you eat and drink. To learn more about us, go to cane5.com.
Running from the law out on the land, sent my mama a wire telegram. Told her I was caught up in a jam. And I said, oh, take me home. And I said, oh.
Hi, we're back on A Taste of the Past, and jumping about a century ahead of the early Dutch settlers, and that would have been in the 1600s, we're going to go ahead to maybe the late 1700s and talk about a sweet that is kind of taking over America. That's the stroopwafel, or stroopwafel, or stroopwafel. I'll have to have Peter pronounce it for me, because I'm sure I would get that one wrong, too. And joining me to talk about this wonderful treat is Tom Daly, and Tom is the CEO of Brand Passport, importer and distributor of Delmon's U.S., and Delmon's is the baking company that produces these wonderful treats. Local bakeries produce them as well. We have a couple of bakeries here in New York that are making stroopwafels. Mostly there's some sort of Dutch connection in there to whoever's baking it, because who else would ever have thought to make up such a wonderful treat like that? Welcome, Tom.
Thank you very much, Linda. Nice to be here.
And tell me a little bit about the, first of all, we're going to talk a little bit about that late 18th century sweet. And supposedly it was started in Gouda?
That's correct.
A baker in Gouda was the first to make the stroopwafel, I see, in the Netherlands. And then when did the Delmon's baking company first start making them on a general production level?
Well, the Delmon's company itself began in 1909, started by one man, Hermanus Delmon's, baking small cakes, actually, and selling them off of a truck at local markets. The company didn't originally start with stroopwafels, but as stroopwafels were invented at about the same time, I'm sure it didn't take very long before Damen's began making stroopwafels themselves.
Hmm. So that company is in the Netherlands, and it's still operating the night from 1909.
Yes, still operating, still family owned since 1909.
Interesting.
It's the largest stroopwafel bakery in the world, actually.
Huh. And they, I noticed because I have a sample in that box of them, and they make them. Usually, it means syrup waffle. Is that the translation of stroopwafel?
That's correct. The Dutch would call that a syrup waffle.
And what was the original or the most the when you say the standard filling in these waffles?
Usually it's a mixture of caramel and cinnamon.
Okay. So as my previous guest, Peter Rose, was describing, they're waffles made in a waffle iron, right, with this syrup. So two waffles put together with the syrup in the middle.
That's correct.
Very thin, right, very thin waffles. All right, so tell us a little bit about the background of how, I'm sure that many of our listeners aren't aware of them, and yet there's a good number of them who will say, oh, I love those things. Tell us how they are consumed and what makes them so popular.
Sure. The stroopwafels themselves, as you said, are it's a very thinly pressed sandwich. It has a crisp bite to it, and then it gets chewy inside. As you mentioned, it's filled with caramel and cinnamon and in our case, bourbon vanilla. And they're terrific right out of the package. But what makes them particularly unique is this wonderful ritual that the Dutch have invented. And that is, if you pour a very hot cup of coffee and you rest your stroopwafel on top of that coffee for about, I don't know, 90 seconds, maybe 2 minutes, the heat from the coffee will warm the filling. And it becomes this gooey, chewy, cinnamon aromatic warm treat that you have with your coffee, not just a room temperature cookie. They're terrific right out of the package. But if you happen to have some coffee nearby, they're really special. And that's why they are available pretty much everywhere you can buy coffee in Holland. You can find stroopwafels as well.
Huh. Well, it seems that suddenly in the past, over the past 5 years or so, they just seem to be springing up all over the place. To what do you attribute this new popularity in the U.S.?
So some of it is just the breadth of the distribution. We started importing this product about 5 years ago, and we went immediately out to national chains, and we're pretty fortunate in securing several of them. Based on the uniqueness of the product and making our sales calls with hot coffee. It's a really unique item, and American grocery buyers are very excited about it when you can show them how it's consumed with coffee. And so we've been fortunate to have the Damen's brand accepted at many of the major chains across the U.S.
Hmm. Well, you also... I'm sorry. You also instituted a very, I guess, kind of brilliant marketing plan. Can you tell us about that, if you took an early flight?
Yes. One of our larger customers today is United Airlines. And if you take an early flight, you will receive a stroopwafel along with your coffee. It's served a complimentary snack to all of the economy cabin customers on flights within North America and to and from Central America, between Honolulu and Guam, and now between Holland and the United States.
Well, I'm glad you don't have to fly that far to get a stroopwafel. I'm glad that you can pick one up at your local grocery store, or find
right.
others at bakeries. But it's interesting that suddenly, the marketing, I guess, made it very popular. And as in any new cookie, I mean, look, the Oreo had to start somewhere, right? And it's the same thing, two cakes with a filling in between. But there is something very special about, I guess maybe it's the tradition and the, about putting it over the hot coffee or the hot tea and making it a special morning treat. Also, I did some reading and found out that it was very popular at holiday time. They saved them maybe for holiday times for a while. I don't know if you have. Yeah. And why wait? Why wait for the Christmas season? Why not just eat them all year round? But I was interested to see that the Dahlmann's Bakery has introduced different flavors of the waffles as well.
Yes. In addition to caramel, we are offering a honey-based variety as well as a maple variety.
Interesting. I don't know, there's something about that original caramel flavor that has me. I don't know if I can separate the two, but they are really quite delicious. And once again, it's one of these Dutch treats. Of course, it's a Dutch treat that came around later than the settlers, and they would be making waffles, but not necessarily these stroopwafels, these, sandwiched together like this. But what a wonderful treat, and for the Dutch to offer to the world, and for Dahlmann's to be still in business. I think that's terrific. And I thank you for letting us know about them and for contributing to the show and to the popularity of these stroopwafels, Tom. This is the brand, I'm sorry, Brand Imports.
Brand Passport,
and they are are you the sole importer of Dahlmann's?
That's correct.
Dahlmann's soup waffles. Interesting. So you can look for these in your grocery stores, and again, thank you very much, and let's have a day of Dutch treats. Thanks for listening.
Thanks for having me.
And thank you for joining me. You've been listening to A Taste of the Past, and I'm your host, Linda Palacio. And this has been a show, a regular show, on the Heritage Radio Network. And I encourage you to log on to the homepage of heritageradionetwork.org and consider giving a donation. We are a charitable organization, a 501c3, and all of our shows are member-supported and sponsored, and we have a beating heart at the top of the page. If you see that beating heart, click onto it and give us a donation. It'll keep our shows going and keep the lights on. Thanks for listening.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes Store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.